WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. At least 70 people are confirmed dead after flash flooding in central Texas. Kerr County Sheriff Larry Letho says search and rescue operations are in full swing.
We have more than a dozen canine working in and near the river. More than 100 air, water, and ground vehicles are in the field right now working on this search and rescue.
CBS's Karen Waugh says many of the victims were children attending summer camp.
Officials say there are still 11 kids missing from Camp Mystic, the Christian all-girls summer camp by the Guadalupe River. This is now day three of the non-stop search. Multiple agencies using helicopters, boats, and drones. The last we heard from Texas Governor Greg Abbott, this is still a search and rescue mission. Officials are still hoping to find people alive. Now, to recap a bit, the timing of this flooding could not have been worse. The 4th of July holiday is one of the busiest weekends of the whole year in Texas Hill Country here. It's a popular recreation area outside Austin and San Antonio.
Gregory Galino with the National Weather Service says rescuers might soon be catching a break.
The outlook is that there's still a potential chance for widely scattered thunderstorms through the afternoon today here on Sunday. Through the rest of the evening and into the overnight hours, there'll still be a chance of the thunderstorm activity in the vicinity. Overall, the pattern is diminishing.
In Myrtle Beach, heavy rain and powerful winds from Tropical Storm Chantel are lashing parts of North and South Carolina. A freeze on sweeping U.S. trade tariffs expires this week. Kevin Hassett, who heads the National Economic Council, says that means we should expect some new trade deals.
When we have great trade deals, our smaller trading partners could become much bigger trading partners. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why countries are racing to set deals up with us ahead of the deadline.
On CBS's Face the Nation, Hassett also spoke about the newly signed Big Beautiful Bill Act, which includes cuts to Medicaid and work requirements as well.
The work requirement is that you need to be looking for work or even doing volunteer work, and you don't need to do it until your kids are 14 or older. And so the idea that that's going to cause a massive hemorrhaging in availability of insurance doesn't make a lot of sense to us.
In Recklinghausen, Germany, a record-breaking 1,353 musicians braved the rain as they gathered in the town square to form the world's largest string orchestra performing Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode to Joy. And when it was all over, the previous record set in Hong Kong in 2018. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Barr. If you're spending more time outside this holiday weekend, experts are warning about a new breed of tick and the bizarre allergy it can spread with just one bite. It's known as the Lone Star tick, and the bug is finding its way to Wisconsin from the southeast part of the country. Doctors with Mayo Clinic say they're already starting to see more patients with what's known as alpha-gal syndrome. It's an allergy to red meat after being bit by this type of tick. And these ticks aren't just in the woods.
You go back 30 years ago and you'd think of, a hunter, an avid hiker out in the woods. Now we're starting to see ticks pop up sometimes in backyards in suburban areas and stuff like that. And that's a concern.
PJ Leash is an entomologist at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And though this new tick is spreading, he still considers Lyme disease from a deer tick the bigger concern. Leash also suggests using insect spray, wearing long sleeves and pants, and always checking for ticks after spending time outside. Are you noticing farmers spending more time outside working in the fields? The weather in some parts of the state is challenging and may not mean all the corn crops are knee-high by the 4th of July. The latest crop report shows farmers across Wisconsin had just 3.5 days with workable conditions during the last week. And did you know our state is ranked second for having the most organic farms in the country? Officials with Naturally Wisconsin and the Food Finance Institute are starting a new program to support those efforts and say there's also growing consumer demand for natural, healthy, and sustainable products. The group's already working with more than 800 food-focused entrepreneurs from all across the state. You can find more news anytime at civicmedia.us. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday. Light north to northeast winds, highs close to the 80-degree mark. Overnight, a few clouds around, lows in the low to mid-50s. On Monday, mostly sunny skies, highs close to 80, some storms Monday night. Right now, it's 79.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll review the holiday weekend. Hope yours has been good. Also, Kristen Lyerly, John and Gordy, and Jane Matinere will join us as well.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9. This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. This is our Independence Day weekend broadcast. As always, taking our name, Amicus, from the notion, the Latin, the legal term for friend, friend of the court, friend of the community. This weekend, consistent with that commission to provide information, insight, and perspective on the world in which we live, we're going to be addressing a great number of things, especially in the wake of our two-part broadcast of last weekend, talking specifically about some of the major cases issued, released by our United States Supreme Court in this 2024-2025 term. We're going to be visiting that in part in this weekend broadcast, talking about some of the consequences of at least two major decisions. There's that one having to do with national or universal injunctions, and the other having to do with the capacity of parents to opt out and not have their children exposed to certain kinds of instruction in public schools. We're going to talk not only about the decisions in those matters, but also perhaps just as importantly, if not more, the consequences, the likely results of those particular cases coming out of the United States Supreme Court. In addition, we're going to talk about some big themes, including this notion that the Supreme Court, increasingly using its emergency docket, will recite once again some specific examples of that and the consequences for the transparency of the court when it comes to pursuing cases, resolving decisions, resolving challenges based not upon a full exposition of the matters before them, but rather pursuant to this emergency, sometimes called a shadow docket. We'll talk again about the ideological split witnessed in some, not all, but some of the cases in the Supreme Court just this past year. Some of the very controversial dissents, we'll visit a couple of those in particular. And then we're going to chat about some of the things that the Supreme Court is plainly continuing to look at into the 2025-2026 term. And yes, that indeed, it does include issues related to transgender matters. We'll talk about all of that as Amicus, a law review, begins our discussion in this weekend broadcast. As always, especially since we reviewed so many cases and so much information in so much detail last weekend, I want to afford all of you a broad and expansive opportunity to be a part of our discussion in this live broadcast this weekend. That phone number is 855-752-4842. Once again, that's 855-752-4842. ask questions that I encourage you to write down last weekend about any of our analyses, our reviews of those major Supreme Court cases. Bring those to my attention so that my producer, Max, and I can get those as a part of our discussion this weekend on Amicus Law Review. In addition to reviewing and getting a sense of the long-term consequences, the trends inside the Supreme Court, we're also going to be looking at a couple, actually three, more recent events having to do with some actions in the criminal courts and one action in a civil court. And we'll talk about the reasons why those non-Supreme Court cases in those other venues are important to understanding what is going on in America when it comes to the administration of justice, the rule of law, and what judges do and do not do. In that connection, we also necessarily, importantly, need to talk about a major decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court of just this past week. Yes, that's right. The Wisconsin Supreme Court finally wrestling with that 1849 law that forbade the conduct, the administration of any medical services in the nature of abortion, reproductive services. The Supreme Court just this past week saying that the 1849 law is no longer in effect. And we'll talk about the reasons why they did that, the impact of that. And then we're going to go more broadly and talk more generally about where abortion stands in America, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but across the nation. What is the status in the wake of the 2022 decision of the Supreme Court finding that there is no longer a privacy right to reproductive opportunities and rights inside the Constitution? What is the consequence of that, not just here in Wisconsin as a result of this recent opinion, but where does it go nationwide? What is the status generally out there? And then, of course, we're necessarily going to talk about the Department of Justice and some major new policies articulated internally and externally to the department about how they're going to go about pursuing the president's policies and activities, again, completely erasing the line that has previously existed between the White House and the Department of Justice there on 9th and Constitution. We'll talk about two major things that the Department of Justice has announced just this past week when it comes to the implementation and the administration of justice coming out of the Department of Justice, the only agency in our federal government that has as its name an aspiration. A lot to take up, a lot to undertake here this weekend on Amicus Law Review. As always, it is indeed ambitious, but it is achievable. Let us begin with that analysis right away. Let us begin by chatting once again about these two major cases among the 66 different opinions issued by the United States Supreme Court just in this past term. Many of them, as we talked in the last weekend's broadcast, issued just about 7 days or so ago, 7-8 days ago, and resolving some major decisions. Principal among those, probably at the top of everyone's list, is this major case involving Trump versus CASA. That's the name of the case. This is the so-called birthright citizenship case. In fact, again, the Supreme Court did not resolve that issue, did not tell us definitively, did not overrule prior Supreme Court opinions and decisions that say that, yes, indeed, if you are born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States. But what the Supreme Court did do, fairly inconsistent with the oral argument of weeks and months earlier, was it said that federal district court judges can no longer issue national universal injunctions. When parties appear before them on big issues, constitutional issues, can no longer make clear that whatever the judges do with respect to an injunction, stopping, for example, an executive order from going ahead, that can no longer be applied across the board to all districts, all places in the nation, is instead restricted presumably just to the district court in which the district in which the district court is sitting, and perhaps even just to the parties in front of them. Now, some districts have done just that, but we know that in connection with many of these cases involving constitutional principles, the judges have gone much more broadly. And the Supreme Court has said in this major opinion authored by Amy Coney Barrett, major opinion written at her pen. The Supreme Court has said no more. If you resolve a case, you can enter injunctive relief. You can enter a temporary restraining order, but you can no longer make that order effective across the nation. And that dramatically changes the way in which we do things in the United States of America. As I've said before, the consequence of that is across the board for all presidents. And while it may seem to be and is for this president a further expansion of his capacities to serve as the president in these executive authorities, it plainly applies to future presidents as well. And so we've talked about, as did the dissenters, to some possibilities about a future president also issuing plainly unconstitutional orders, but requiring that to push back on them, to get them enjoined, to get them stopped. Now, based upon this order, this ruling of the Supreme Court, individual plaintiffs, individual challengers will need to go into individual federal district courts around the country. There are 93 of them, 93 different districts, and seek the vindication of their rights. Sonia Sotomayor, for example, identified a couple of options here. One is, plainly, if a party is concerned about a president who suddenly has directed, contrary to the Second Amendment, that all guns be seized, all guns be surrendered. In the past, a federal district court judge, for example, in this hypothetical, could have issued a nationwide injunction saying that's not consistent with the law as interpreted by the Supreme Court, and therefore it's illegal, cannot apply across the board. Now, under this new ruling, under this hypothetical situation, the reality is that individuals who own guns would need to go into their particular district court and get their right vindicated there. Another example that's used is under the First Amendment. If, for example, an equally out of control president in the future should wake up one morning and say, I'm no longer going to permit people to exercise their faith as they like, that's plainly in violation of the First Amendment, the free exercise clause. If a Christian, a Jew, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Sikh wanted to go into their synagogue, their temple, their church, their gurdwara, no longer subject to a national jurisdiction injunction imposed by a judge, would need to go into their local federal district court and get permission to worship as they choose. That would change dramatically the way in which we understand the law, understand the import of the jurisdiction of federal courts. And the likely result coming out of the Supreme Court, that is splitting things in half, saying there may indeed be those cases where there are large issues of the constitutional dimension. I just mentioned two hypothetical situations, the First Amendment right to religious exercise, a second one, the right to bear arms, both of those constitutionally protected. Those may be the kinds of things that would have national impact. And so a rule identifying major, significant constitutional rights, those could be the subject of national injunctions. There may be other things, as Amy Coney Barrett was suggesting during the course of the oral argument, that would not be in that category. And so one of the things that appeared the Supreme Court was heading toward was the articulation of a rule that described for lower judges exactly what falls in one category and what falls in the other. Not at all an easy thing to do, but nonetheless the kind of thing the Supreme Court does routinely, including even in this term, as it articulated, for example, inside an employment case, standards for the litigation of discrimination cases under Title VII. Supreme Court does that all the time. Here the Supreme Court, in this very definitive opinion written by Amy Coney Barrett, says no rule out there. There is a bright line prohibition on national injunctions, universal injunctions, and without much of an opportunity to get around that. There are a couple of things they talk about. They talk about, of course, the possibility of states through the attorneys general vindicating in federal courts, maybe in state courts as well, the rights that an attorney general might pursue on behalf of her or his constituents throughout the state. That remains an option. There are also class actions, not an easy thing to do, requiring class certification, identification of large groups of people who fall into the same category. That's also out there, the Supreme Court suggested. And third, There is this continuing avenue under the Administrative Procedures Act. We've talked about that. It's fairly wonky. It's in the weeds. But it also requires when government does things, it needs to do those things according to rules and regulations, standards permitting people to come in and have their voices heard about what government is doing. So the Supreme Court identified workarounds, if you will, that are still available. And yes, indeed, district court judges still do have injunctive relief. It is simply narrowed dramatically. The big takeaway, of course, is a change in the way that federal courts work. When we come back, we'll talk about the larger implications for this presidency and any future presidency, and then talk about three instances in which federal district judges are indeed pursuing those workarounds, even in the wake of this major Supreme Court decision. When Amicus, a law review, returns.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Ever since I started the recombobulation area, I've written an in-depth breakdown of every new edition of the Marquette University Law School poll. The newest poll asks about a range of topics, whether Tony Evers should run for a third term, where people stand on Donald Trump's economic policies, and a host of issues relating to the state budget. The poll paints a picture of a polarized Wisconsin. Many people are very dug into their partisan camps, which is perhaps to be expected in the most evenly divided state in the nation. But there are a number of issues polled that do have the support of more than two-thirds of Wisconsin voters. Those include extending Medicaid coverage for new moms, legalizing marijuana, making major increases in state aid for special education, providing mental health services in schools, allowing citizen-led ballot initiatives, and banning cell phones in schools. What do most of these issues have in common? They are policies being advanced by Democrats in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. The Todd Allbaugh Show.
Why do we want to be proud to be an American? Why are we celebrating the United States?
Let's say that you're going to define America in political terms. I define it in terms of what the Founding Fathers did in 1776. An ideal that we are still trying to fully live up to. That all men, all people, I would say, are created equal. All Americans are represented by the stars and stripes. I love the 4th of July.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local civic media radio station. And on the app.
Mommy, can I sit in the front seat just this one time? Please, please, please.
No, not yet.
But why?
Because I love you, and you're just not ready yet. Now, get in the back so I can get you in your car seat, please.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Small businesses are the heart of America. As the nation's largest nonprofit resource of expert business mentoring, SCORE has helped millions of entrepreneurs build their businesses. For free, find a mentor today at score.org.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, throughout this hour and next hour, taking your phone calls, your comments, your questions, your inquiries at 855-752-4842. You can also drop a comment, question, inquiry into our chat line, and we'll also make that a part of our discussion this weekend. We're spending some time doing some 20 or 30,000 foot analysis of what the Supreme Court has done in this term, talking right now about the major impact, about what is probably the most significant case. That is this case called Trump versus CASA, C-A-S-A, in which the Supreme Court, through the pen of Amy Coney Barrett, said no more national universal injunctions. You need to run into your local federal district court and get every single right of yours pursued and challenged with respect to any executive order, anything the government does, get your rights vindicated by individual applications, noting along the way that there are mechanisms for doing that under the Administrative Procedures Act and class actions, and maybe even state attorneys general pursuing your claims on your behalf in those courts. The largest takeaway historically, however, on the CASA case, in addition to all of the changes that it has already accomplished and will accomplish in the future, is the bookend. We recall well that it was just a year ago that the Supreme Court, in this major catastrophic decision called Trump versus the United States, found not only that a president is immune from criminal prosecution for things that he, one day she, may do in office, for many of those things, some of them expressly identified, but also found in those first pages that the executive needs to be muscular, needs to be very nimble, needs to be deft, cannot be feeble, as the Chief Justice said, need to be able to act in exactly the way that this president has been acting for the past 5 months or so, giving him that authority expressly. That is the rule of law in America today by virtue of that case decided 1 year ago in this week. Last week, the Supreme Court provides us all with the bookend to that and says, OK, in addition to giving the president all of this authority, basically to do what he needs to do and issue these executive orders, if you challenge those, you can no longer get them reversed at a national level. You need to go in and do this in a way that is far less effective than it has ever been before. You need to go in once again to vindicate your individual, maybe class rights, but it again strengthens dramatically the authority of this president and any future president to do what he or she wants to do, even if it's in violation of the Constitution. And yes, indeed, a future unconstitutionally acting president may find himself, herself on the receiving end of an individually district court issued injunction. The reality is that that is far less effective, far less significant in terms of stopping that unconstitutional behavior than we had just a week earlier. And so these two decisions, Trump versus United States, July 1 of 2024, and Trump versus CASA, June 26, 2025, they vest in the president a huge amount of power we've never seen before and doesn't give him carte blanche to do anything he wants, but makes it much easier for him or her to pursue those policies that may in fact be unconstitutional without the capacity to get them stopped fairly quickly and decisively as we had before. A dramatic change once again given to the executive by the Supreme Court. I indicated just before the break that there are indeed some workarounds. And indeed, one of the good news items coming out of just the past week is that it appears that federal district court judges are taking the Supreme Court at its word and saying, yes, I can do certain things. I can enjoin certain activities. I don't have to issue national injunctions, but I can still act. And indeed, the rule of law is alive and well in America. Let's talk about some of the things that federal district court judges have done just in the past week in the wake of that decision, CASA, that seemingly shut it down much of their injunctive relief. Turns out that district court judges invoking the Administrative Procedures Act, indicating that indeed larger groups of people like class actions can in fact get results, even if they're limited to their particular districts, and also finding again through the APA a measure of solace when it comes to pushing back on the unconstitutional and administratively illegal things that a president may be doing. So let's talk about three of those. A federal judge in New York on Tuesday of this past week blocks the Trump administration. This again in the wake following the Supreme Court's decision, CASA, stops the Trump administration from ending temporary legal status for about 500,000 Haitians who are already in the United States of America. We have talked about this case before. District Court Judge Brian Cogan, he's in New York. He rules that moving up the expiration of the temporary protected status, recall this, the TPS program, by at least 5 months for these groups of Haitians, some of whom have lived in the United States of America for more than a decade, that's unlawful. You recall, as we talked about this before, the Biden administration had extended Haiti's TPS status through at least February 3rd of 2026, based upon its findings about gang violence and political unrest and some other things there. A major earthquake in 2021, several other factors as well. Last week, the Department of Homeland Security announced it was terminating those legal protections as soon as September 2nd. And then the deportees from Haiti, the Haitians there, presumably going to be the subject of that. In a 23 pages, the judge says that the Department of Homeland Security's move to terminate the legal protections early violates the temporary protective status of the Haitians. And that, of course, requires that a certain amount of notice be considered before that designation is given. The judge goes on to say, when the government confers a benefit over a fixed period of time, a beneficiary can reasonably expect to receive that benefit at least until the end of the fixed period. That is one judge doing something in the wake of what the Supreme Court said, invoking injunctive relief. When we come back, a couple of more instances of the same thing going on in trial courts around the country here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, home of the Big High School Sports Show.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
CBS News Brief. At least 70 people are confirmed dead after flash flooding in Central Texas. That includes several children attending summer camp. Forecaster Gregory Galena says the storm isn't done yet.
Unfortunately, the tropical moisture plume that's still in the vicinity is still generally trapped between North Texas through the Hill Country into the lower Rio Grande Valley.
Search and rescue operations continue. A freeze on sweeping U.S. trade tariffs expires this week, and that means higher tariff rates could boomerang back. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent spoke about that during an interview on CNN.
It's not a new deadline. We are saying this is when it's happening. If you want to speed things up, have at it. If you want to go back to the old rate, that's your choice.
Actor Richard Gere saying happy birthday to the Dalai Lama.
You're one of the most extraordinary people who have ever walked on this planet.
The Dalai Lama is 90 today. CBS News Brief.
A Brewer injury. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers wrapping up their three-game series against the Marlins in Miami today. Milwaukee losing yesterday 4-2. And they lost veteran first baseman Reese Hoskins, who left the game with an injured thumb on his left hand. How bad is it? Manager Pat Murphy after the game.
Yeah, it doesn't look great. It's not fractured. I don't know after that. He doesn't feel great right now. And I think it's going to be super sore for it's your bottom hand swinging. So it's very, really important. It's that thumb. I don't think we'll see him for a few days, but hopefully it's not an IL, but it might be, depending on how he feels in the next few days.
Did he even try to grip a bat?
He did. He said it didn't feel very good. He said he could squeeze a glove. They did all the testing they do out there. I could tell it was killing him, but he finished the inning and then came in, tried to grab a bat. He said, no, I can't grab a bat. For it to be like that, and Reese Hoskins, because I know who he is, it's got to be really hurting him.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy with Sports on Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. The Devil Wears Prada is coming back, but not every cast member will return. The production started last week on Prada 2. Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway, Emily Blunt, and Stanley Tucci are all back. Adrian Grenier, however, will not be back as Nate Cooper in the sequel. He played Anne Hathaway's love interest and a short order cook in the first film. Grenier's claim to fame is, of course, the show Entourage, but he has not done much since. In other casting news, actor Kenneth Branagh will join the production as Meryl Streep's character, Miranda Priestley's husband. There's a new action comedy that might be worth a look. Heads of State tells the story of the UK Prime Minister, played by Idris Elba, and the United States President, played by John Cena, which seems more realistic than it's ever been. The two characters butt heads but have to team up to overthrow a global plot that threatens freedom. The film is receiving a 66% on Rotten Tomatoes and an 85% audience score and can be streamed on Amazon Prime. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday. Light north to northeast winds, highs close to the 80-degree mark. Overnight, a few clouds around, lows in the low to mid-50s. On Monday, mostly sunny skies, highs close to 80. Some storms Monday night. Currently 80 degrees.
Matt and Air on Air.
PJ Leash, the bug guy, he heads the entomology department at UW-Madison, and we are talking ticks.
When a deer tick transmits Lyme disease, it takes 36 hours, so about a day and a half. And that's why, in my mind, one of the single best things you can do as a precaution is to do regular tick checks. Because you've removed it, your risk goes down greatly to basically zilch.
Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Tracy Ann Mangold, how would you describe what it is that Brian Schimming is caught in the crossfires of?
He's the first paid state chair that they've ever had. And so the belief was that maybe that'll increase his ability to fundraise for the state. Obviously, that has not worked out so well. I've been told that he thinks 4 phone calls a day to fundraise is a lot, which, you know, isn't.
104 might be a good start.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll review the holiday weekend. Hope yours has been good. Also, Kristen Lyerly, John and Gordy, and Jane Matinair will join us as well.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are talking in this first hour of our weekend broadcast about the consequences of some of these major decisions issued by our United States Supreme Court in the final days of its active release of decisions just last week and in the weeks prior to that, noting once again that the Supreme Court has said that national injunctions across the board, applying to all districts, no longer available to litigants, petitioners, challengers in the courts. Nonetheless, we have district court judges who are invoking a thing called the Administrative Procedures Act, invoking other possible avenues, including class actions, to still issue orders preventing this administration from doing various things. We talked about this order issued by Brian Kogan in New York having to do with the Department of Homeland Security's move to terminate the legal protections of about 500,000 Haitians here in America. There's more. You've got a federal district court in Rhode Island on Tuesday ordering the Trump administration to stop a series of planned layoffs at the United States Department of Health and Human Services. We have talked a lot about those, and you have digested those as well. This is a 58-page opinion by District Judge Melissa DuBose. She has granted a motion for a preliminary injunction barring the government from, as she said, taking any actions to implement or enforce any firings or planned restructurings. The judge taking the government to task for trying to avoid spending money already allocated by the Congress. She says, in the case at hand, Congress directed the Department of Health and Human Services to maintain specific initiatives with the support of the congressional appropriations pursuant to the applicable statutes. Went on to say HHS cannot decide for itself whether it has exceeded its statutory authority because there are congressional statutes in place to serve as guardrails. There's that word, guardrails, to the agency's actions. She says this court concludes that the defendants, that is the administration, usurped congressional power to manage the public health appropriations at stake, and the states are likely to succeed on their contrary-to-law claims. That as a part of this order, again, in the wake of what the Supreme Court has done. And yet there's more. And this one also specifically invoking the Administrative Procedures Act. This happens on Wednesday of this past week. There is a 128-page opinion by Judge Randolph Moss. He is sitting there in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. He rules just on Wednesday that the Trump administration cannot categorically deny asylum claims from people crossing the southern border. This is very significant. It's striking down one of the changes made on President Trump's first days in office. The ruling rejects the idea, which is repeatedly been advanced by the administration that these extraordinary powers exercised by the president are justified to curtail, to address what Donald Trump has repeatedly called an invasion by the United States by immigrants crossing the border. Again, 128 pages. The judge, Randolph Moss, there says this: the court recognizes that the executive branch faces enormous challenges in preventing and deterring unlawful entry into the United States and in adjudicating the overwhelming backlog of asylum claims of those who have entered the country. Goes on to say, but neither the Constitution nor current law governing asylum seekers can be read to grant the president or his delegates, the people who work on his behalf, authority to adopt an international and alternative immigration system which supplants the statutes that the Congress has enacted. The order, once again, coming in the wake of this decision by the Supreme Court that no national injunctions can be entered, finding in this case that the Trump's proclamation was called guaranteeing the state's protection against invasion, seeking to suspend the nation's refugee admissions program, overriding the direction of Congress, set in something called the Immigration Nationality Act. All of that cannot go forward. This judge, once again, as are the others, invoking other mechanisms. And yes, indeed, broadly enjoining events from happening, but doing it not so much under constitutional bases, but in violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, that is saying that the administration is acting in violation of the APA, and also establishing, when you get into the weeds of these cases, the particular facts that permit judges in their discretion to do these kinds of things as to those plaintiffs, as to those challengers who are before them. Class actions, APA, all of this continues to provide some mechanisms. We will see about the extent to which these workarounds, again, expressly adopted and embraced by the Supreme Court, do in fact get back to the Supreme Court as a procedural matter. And history will tell plainly about the consequences of what is still undeniably a major decision that does give this president, any future president, a whole lot more power to do what he or she opines is appropriate to do, especially in the wake of that decision a year ago, giving a president a huge amount of authority to act in the first place. Lots of things going on here. Let's talk about that other major case that we described during the course of our discussion last weekend. This one has to do with academic freedoms and also religious rights and the capacity of parents who, based upon religious beliefs, do not want their children, their school-age children, to be exposed to storybooks with LGBTQIA themes. We know that this case is pending in front of the Supreme Court coming out of Maryland. The district there had, after a lot of experimentation, prohibited parents from opting their young children out, and in the end saying, no, we are responsible for teaching your children responsibly. We know what we're doing. And the parents, again, based upon religious grounds, said that we are opposed to what is being taught when it comes to these LGBTQIA missions and purposes and themes, a position that Sam Alito, in language that is quite dramatically different from what the Supreme Court said when it was deciding about the dignity of human beings in connection with those same-sex marriage cases many years ago. Sam Alito saying, nope. It may well be that people who have different views about LGBTQIA rights not only have the right to maintain those views, which they do, but also have the right to prevent their children on religious grounds from hearing anything about them. And so directing the Maryland school districts to do carve-outs to ensure that the parents have the opportunity to opt out with respect to a particular lesson on LGBTQIA storybooks. Interestingly, as I said last weekend, those opinions, both the majority opinion, the dissenting opinion, attached to the text of the orders some fascinating things. There are color pictures of the books, of excerpts from the pages of those books. Obviously, the majority attaching them to say, see, this is what we're looking at. This is the problem that the Maryland Cleveland School District has. The dissenter is saying, see, this is how benign and non-controversial this is. The dissenter is again going on to say that's what education is all about. Sonia Sotomayor in particular describing the purposes of education being exposing everyone to views and perspectives with which they may not agree. For religious reasons, for other reasons, but that's education, she says, and it does not undermine, as Sonia Sotomayor and the other two dissenters said, the capacity of young children, even young children, to learn. And most importantly, and here's the point, here's the large-term consequence, the capacity, the ability, the responsibility vested in school boards and teachers and principals and the designers of academic curriculums to teach as their expertise and their experience and their background, their education indicates. And here's the consequence. This is about LGBTQIA storybooks. If indeed, as we talked last weekend, if a parent comes along and says, my religion tells me that my young students should no longer be exposed to anything having to do with the scientific concept of evolution, I want that to be redacted out of the curriculum and redacted out of the education given my young boy or girl in school. What about other things, again, premised upon religious beliefs about the way the homes should be crafted? Mothers stay at home, fathers go to work. My religion tells me that's right. I don't want my young boy or girl exposed to anything other than that kind of a family setup. Based upon what the Supreme Court has opened the door to now, admittedly, in this case, just about LGBTQ storybooks, but down the road, other issues, again, premised upon religious beliefs, maybe upon political beliefs, demanding that their school districts not expose my student, my young school-age student, to a particular subject matter. Right now, across the board, as we are in summer terms, school districts and school boards and teachers and principals should be looking very carefully at this case, Mahmoud versus Taylor, to determine what is next. What can parents now ask of teachers and of academics in these settings to prevent them and to require opt-outs, preventing them from educating in certain subject matters? You can fill in the blank on what those may be. Like this other case involving the way that the courts work injunctively, this case changes the way that our schools work. And again, I have no doubt that school boards and administrators, superintendents, teachers in the classrooms, not just of kindergartners and first and second, fourth and fifth graders, but everyone K through 12, looking at this case, Mahmoud, and saying, gosh, what if I have a parent who says, I no longer want this particular scientific or arithmetic or even literature related thing taught in my schools to my children? Are schools now obliged to grant that request to opt out? It appears from the Supreme Court the consequences of Mahmoud is that they would need to do that. A dramatic change in the way that our schools work coming up for the 2025-2026 academic term. Right now, school districts around the country looking at that case and determining what their policies should be. All of that having to do with the significant consequences of the substance of what the Supreme Court has done just in this past year. We know as well that there are huge ideological splits. We've seen many of those in cases like, once again, the birthright citizenship, that's 6-3. The opt-out in the classroom, that's 6-3. We talked about this age verification for adult sites, that's 6-3. We talked about this case involving preventive care, in which the Supreme Court does indeed support the task forces that permit the decisions to be made about what kinds of preventive care insurance companies are obliged to provide under the Affordable Care Act. But that was also 6-3. Another 6-3 opinion, transition care for trans youth. That was 6-3, giving the states the capacity to prohibit healthcare providers from providing transgender care to transgender youth. That was a 6-3 decision as well. There was that 4-4 decision that was split right down the middle on religious charter schools. Remember this one coming out of Oklahoma? Decided principally, or not decided, because Amy Coney Barrett
wasn't deciding the case. And so the case goes back to the Oklahoma folks with the affirmation that what the Oklahoma Supreme Court said, which is that those charter schools could not become a part of the public schools because of their religious instruction. But that was 4-4 also. And so we had many cases of this past term in which there was split majorities and minorities on the court. There were also those unanimous decisions, 9-0, that reverse discrimination case I made reference to. Every justice saying, yes, indeed, we've got to have uniformity when it comes to applying Title VII. That gunmaker liability coming out of Mexico attempting to assign liability for much of its violent crime to gun makers here in America. The Supreme Court 9-0 saying, nope, no such thing, cannot do that under the congressional legislation. Ghost guns, somewhat related to that, finding that indeed they can be regulated by the administration.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Thomas Jefferson is credited with most of the text of the Declaration of Independence, but the independence part came from a Virginian named Richard Henry Lee on June 7, 1776. The First Continental Congress sent a list of grievances in 1774 to King George III, among them the loss of their rights under English law, the occupation by British forces in peacetime, and the oppressive coercive acts passed by Parliament to shut down colonial unrest. The King and Parliament didn't respond other than to pass more restrictive laws. By mid-May 1776, 8 colonies supported independence, including Virginia, which directed its delegates to support independence at the Second Continental Congress. Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee on June 7th presented his resolution for independence to the Congress in Philadelphia, which tabled action until July 2nd. In the interim, Thomas Jefferson, with light editing by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, crafted a statement which would become the Declaration of Independence, which included Richard Henry Lee's independence resolution word for word. Resolved that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. Read the full Declaration of Independence at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Time out!
All right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. My training helps me at work when I lead by example. The Army National Guard has taught me the value of showing respect to those I come in contact with each day. My service also allows me to be there for my community in ways others can't. I help my hometown recover after nature strikes. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country and those I care about safe from threats. I also work with a network of professionals that help me succeed and accomplish the mission. Plus, the Army National Guard education benefits make getting a higher education a reality. Being an Army National Guard soldier makes living and serving in my community more rewarding every day. Learn how you too can live and serve part-time, close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
The
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santelis, always taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. We also have some comments, and we'll get to those in the top of our second hour, all about what the Supreme Court is and is not doing, talking a lot about the substance of what it's done and the consequences, apolitically, without a partisan perspective, on what the future holds and the reason why we are now living in a time when the Supreme Court has said for this president and future presidents, the notion that you can indeed engage in activities and issue executive orders in the capacity of a very strong and muscular presidency. That was last year. We know, again, as of a week ago, that the Supreme Court has also further defined the power of the executive branch to limit dramatically the capacity of any challengers today, 4 years from now, 8 years from now, 10 years from now, to go in and stop an executive who is engaging in conduct that is viewed as unconstitutional. All those things should be of concerns to individuals across the political aisle because they don't just apply today. They apply to all presidents down the road. We recognize as well that there are ideological splits in the Supreme Court that will continue and that there are standards by which the Supreme Court applies its decisions. Sometimes Americans appropriately will disagree with those. Sometimes they will support those. That too is the beauty of our system in which political perspectives and government perspectives and legal perspectives have a right to be heard in the public domain. There's another aspect of what we saw an awful lot of in this term that should be of concern to people across the political aisle, because once again, it opens up a mechanism, a procedural mechanism, at a level that we have not seen before. For prior administrations, there have indeed been lots of applications for emergency action, typically involving the administration and execution of the death penalty. We have seen in recent years, not just in this administration, not just in the Biden administration, not just in Trump 1, but in other administrations, an increasing use of this going to the court and asking for an emergency application, even while lower courts are still addressing the underlying litigation. Stop that from happening. Enjoin that from happening. It's called the emergency docket, and it has reached fever pitch. And once again, the reasons why all Americans should be concerned about this is because the result of this emergency application is, number one, to jump over effectively the normal course of litigation that sometimes results in favorable actions to challengers, sometimes results in unfavorable actions. But going right away to a Supreme Court and asking them to intervene, Supreme Court has done that 19 times since January 20th of this year. And again, why is that a problem? Why is that to be viewed in any way as concerning? It's because of the way that it is done. Unlike all those other 66 cases, including, yes, indeed, the Casa case and the Mahmoud case and all those others we talked about, those are the product of transparency. And whether you agree with them or not, you have to say that they were given the process that they deserve. That includes the lawyers writing briefs, appearing in front of the Supreme Court for oral arguments, and doing all those things that are a part of the judicial process that winnows and sifts and comes in the end to decisions about how cases should be resolved. The difficulty with the emergency, sometimes called the shadow docket, is that we don't get any of that. And indeed, here are a couple of instances among many others from just the past 5 months. You know well that in early June, the Supreme Court let members of the Musk team have access to sensitive records of millions of Americans held by the Social Security Administration. Now, again, that was not without a dissent, a vigorous dissent authored by Sonia Sotomayor, and we talked a lot about that when that decision was issued. The point is that the reason for granting that was unknown. The court's order permitting that access was brief, unsigned, and no reasons given. You can simply do that. The Supreme Court simply saying, we're going to let the government go ahead and do the work that it needs to do. That as a part of the Social Security Administration case and the access to those materials. There was another one
that has been back in the news as well. Again, many others out there as well. This is the case involving the so-called South Sudan deportees. You may recall there was Brian Murphy at the lower court who has directed, pursuant to congressional legislation, that these 8 or 9 deportees, they ended up in Djibouti and South Sudan, are in fact eligible to be deported, should be deported, he effectively says, but need to be told, need to be given advice, need to be given the opportunity to contest the location of where they are deported to. And that's what he said in his orders. The Supreme Court comes back, and again, in an unsigned and undescribed order, says, nope, the administration does have the capacity to go ahead and deport these people, presumably, but not clearly, without affording them due process. The judge comes back and says, I don't know what the Supreme Court has told me to do. And he goes ahead with this order. And sure enough, late last week, the Supreme Court comes back and has to re-clarify what it has done or not done in the first instance way back in late June, and says, no, we went and we said the administration can go ahead with the deportation of these deportees now in Djibouti, now in South Sudan, other places, without giving them the notice of where they're going and where they're headed pursuant to the legislation. And they did that once again, initially and again recently, without the exposition that you normally get in these other cases. The result of that is a court that's no longer, at least in these instances, is not transparent. And absent that, the concern that you have is a Supreme Court now issuing decisions on major cases, and there are more plainly out there, in which we do not get a description about the reasons why they're doing it. That's a good thing. You may not agree with the majority. You may not agree with the dissenters, but it is good to be able to read the reasons why they feel the way they do and to take those apart. That's what we miss when this focus upon the emergency shadow docket takes over the docket of the Supreme Court. When we come back on Amicus, we're going to shift to some other major cases in America that have happened just recently. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Search and rescue operations continue after flash flooding in central Texas. Kerrville City Manager Dalton Rice says at least 70 people have been killed.
We are seeing bodies recovered all over, up and down.
Did people in the region have advance warning of the flooding? CBS's Karen Waugh reports.
The big question on day three remains, was there any sort of emergency alert, phone message, siren, warning people about this flash flooding on Friday? We know at this point the Texas Department of Emergency Management put resources in place Thursday when they heard forecasts of at least 8 inches of rain. Officials say they didn't realize the rain would be much heavier than 8 inches, but we want to know if any warning was still given to residents or folks in this area.
Several people remain missing, including girls attending summer camp who were swept away. Folks in the Carolinas are starting to